Blog Talk Radio.
Today's program is a continuation of my August 10th broadcast. Go and see the movie Detroit or rent it on Netflix to understand the context of today's discussion. And here's an overview of where we started last month, shortly after the movie debuted across the country. To think about the new movie Detroit represented a comprehensive look at a terrible event that took place in July of 1967 is only to give credence to part of a complex story. Yes, again, go see the movie, but realize it's only covering a segment of a citywide episode in Detroit's long history. I was born in a black hospital in Detroit and largely raised in a middle-class neighborhood on the city's west side. My story is what the movie didn't capture, as it opened the closet door of a major metropolitan city at the crossroads of civil rights, Vietnam, and unrest everywhere. Today's show is a personal one again for me, and an opportunity to add layers of truth onto a movie that opened old wounds dating back more than 50 years. Hello, this is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Hi, everybody. Just waiting for my theme music. I'm in a remote location, and the music is not queuing up the way it should, so I'm just going to get going. Hello, my friends. Thank you so much for listening to today's show. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and we have lots going on here. I'm going to get to our main subject in just a minute or two, but I want to, first of all, bring to your attention a really important event that is coming up next weekend here in the greater Boston area. I am going to pop over to the screen so that I can bring up the information and let you know about Children's Services of Roxbury. They are a wonderful, wonderful organization. They service a lot of people in the greater Boston area, and they are having a fantastic event called Peace of Mind. And Peace of Mind, and this is what they're saying, this is all in support of International Day of Peace. We support peace of mind for all Massachusetts families while raising awareness and much needed funds. And to reinforce this message, we are assembling over 6,000 people to form the world's largest human peace sign on the Boston Common. I'm excited about it. I plan on participating, and it will take place, I believe, next weekend. I may get my dates mixed up, either next weekend or the following weekend. But most importantly, if you go to CSRpeaceofmind.org, that's CSRpeaceofmind.org, you will get all the information. It's very reasonable in terms of the price. I think it's like $10 to sign up. And again, this is going to be Saturday. This is in 2 weeks. Saturday, September 23rd, this is when Children's Services of Roxbury plans on, like breaking a Guinness record, forming a human chain, a peace sign with over 6,000 people. So you can go on over to csrpeaceofmind.org and sign up. Tickets are reasonable. They start at $10 and they go down from there, so family prices are less. But support this really fabulous human service organization as they attempt to break a record and set up a 6,000 person human peace sign. That's on Saturday, September 23rd. Now, also, we know there's a lot of information going on about the hurricanes that have, one that just passed with Hurricane Harvey, and to Hurricane Harvey, which took place in Texas and did a lot of damage. There going to be cleaning up from that for quite a long time. If you go to my website, that's tellcarole.com, TellCarole.com, go to the blog section, and the blog that I put up about a week ago gives detailed information about where you can donate either goods or money to those who were affected by Hurricane Harvey. Some locations that are accepting actual tangible goods, and then there are other locations that are asking for cash. So it's a pretty extensive list. Again, at my website, you can go there and you can check it out and make a contribution accordingly. Also, in your respective cities, I know that several organizations across the country are collecting goods locally and then transporting them down to Texas. So again, you can check that out on the local level, or certainly look at the list that I have compiled, which includes several Houston-based organizations and how they are asking for donations. We are probably going to have to do the same thing because of the damage currently being done with Hurricane Irma that has just ravaged parts of the Caribbean islands. It's bearing down right now on Puerto Rico, the island of Barbuda. I was not familiar with that country, that island country. They have they've had just extensive damage. The eye of the hurricane actually crossed over their entire island. So 95% of their buildings were either damaged or destroyed. And I believe 60% of the people who live on that island, or I may be getting it mixed up with St. Martin, are now homeless because of their circumstances. So again, a really tough situation that the people in the Caribbean islands face, and that the residents of Florida are going to face come this weekend, and perhaps North and South Carolina, depending on the path of Hurricane Irma. So we will have updated information again where you can donate for Hurricane Irma once the dust settles. But in the meantime, please go to the website and you can give information. You can get information about Hurricane Harvey and how you can donate accordingly. We will be talking in future weeks about my upcoming really exciting conference that's taking place November 2nd, Thursday, November 2nd. We've launched it. The Multicultural Conference will take place on the campus of the Massachusetts College of Art and Design. You can go again to tellcarole.com, TellCarole, or MSS. You can click through and complete information about the conference, how you can register online. Early bird rates end on September 30th, are there, and people are registering. It's going to be an excellent event, Women, Work, and Celebrating Self-Worth. That is the title of our conference. So we'd love for you to come. Please bring your colleagues and coworkers. And again, we'll talk more about that later. So I want to now spend the rest of the time just talking again about this movie, Detroit. That it's a gripping movie. It's a movie about just absolutely horrific police brutality that took place at the Algiers Motel in July of 1967 when the Detroit riots broke out. You can go back and listen to the previous show that I did on August 10th, and again, that's at the blog section on my website. You can go back and you can get a sense of what happened during that time. And also, I have on that blog page the timeline for the riots, got the information online, and I've recreated it on the website so you can get a sense of how it started. You'll learn about blind pigs. You'll learn about the police raid that took place on the corner of 12th and Virginia Park, it's now Rosa Parks Boulevard, and how that erupted ultimately into the Detroit riots. The movie, understandably so, didn't cover the scope of the riot itself. It only covered one incident that took place at the Algiers Motel on Virginia Park and Woodward Avenue that then just was a chilling event where three people were killed by, in the police hands, and others were tortured as a result of that raid that took place at that location. I did see the movie. I did see it with friends who are also from Detroit. We have yet to, because of the summer season, but we will be convening a discussion about the movie. But the main thing that I want to share with you is the landscape and what took place in Detroit during that time. Like many cities, you have different neighborhoods, you have socioeconomic differences that determine neighborhoods, and that's really important to understand. Because to look at Detroit today, and maybe what your impressions may be of Detroit, is not to understand the Detroit of the 60s. Detroit of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s represented a major metropolitan city, upwards of 1 million people, heavily tied to the automobile industry. And with that, thousands of people from all over the country, let alone all over the world, who came with hopes and promises of a job, a home, a steady income where they could raise their family. And that American dream was realized, again, for decades in Detroit. That's the Detroit that I grew up in. Even though my parents did not work in the auto industry, the effect of our household income, the level of comfort that we enjoyed, because I did grow up in a middle-class family, had everything to do with the success of the auto industry. Things began to change in the 70s and certainly in the 80s. But in the 60s, the economy was still fairly robust. But, this is a big but it did not mean that there were not racially motivated incidences and racially motivated decisions in Detroit that impacted people of color, because it did. So, yes, in the South, we had arbitrary segregation, but you also had segregation in the North, and you had segregation in Detroit and other cities in the North, such as Chicago and New York, etc. The segregation played itself out in terms of housing patterns and where people lived. And so you had certain neighborhoods that were populated by black people who had largely come up from the South, again, to live and work in Detroit, principally in the automobile industry or the related industries you had going on. And largely, neighborhoods where blacks were steered, where they could live, they could only live. You couldn't live in certain neighborhoods in Detroit, by and large, because of segregation. That impacted my family and others. And also some of the industries and some of the jobs that you could and could not have depended on the color of your skin. That was, again, decades old. So as a result of that, you had certain neighborhoods and certain blacks who were college educated or had completed high school and were performing well and had certain jobs or career paths that allowed them to live comfortably. My parents were in that category. Both of my parents were college graduates. My grandparents were college graduates. And so they were afforded the opportunity to live in these segregated neighborhoods, but in very nice homes, homes where you could start off in one place and then move to a larger home. And because of the automobile industry, you had neighborhoods or blocks and streets that had very large homes. You had mid-sized homes with two or three bedrooms, maybe a bath and a half or whatever. And then you had homes that had four and five bedrooms and a couple of bathrooms and attics that were turned into bedroom areas, et cetera. So I'm saying all this because when I was growing up, I lived in both kinds of houses. I started off in a smaller house, but the same neighborhood, just four blocks away, in a home that had, I believe, four bedrooms, bathrooms, etc., but a very stable, middle-class black neighborhood. And then I moved to my grandparents' house when my parents divorced and moved with my mother, And that home was very large. It had 6 bedrooms, a couple of bathrooms. It was a large house with a large side lot. And it was on Chicago Boulevard. I mentioned that because the homes in that on that street and Boston Boulevard were targeted during the riot, where some of the rioters wanted to come over to those streets in particular, and as far as Edison, which was a street in the same area, there was a Boston Edison Association, which was like a neighborhood block club, a large neighborhood block club, where some of the rioters wanted to come over and burn the houses. And I had mentioned earlier that the stores across the street from my own home were burned. Clothes that I had in the cleaners were burned up. And one store in particular that was owned by a Chaldean family, which was very common. Chaldeans are from largely what is now known as Iraq and other parts of the Middle East. And they put a Soul Brothers sign in their window. And as a result of that, their store was not burned. So lots of things going on. You had, again, targeted neighborhoods, not just my neighborhood, but other neighborhoods in other parts of Detroit, which were comfortably middle class or upper middle class, that were threatened with this kind of violent activities. And, again, to the segregated system that was in place in Detroit at that time, where, yes, you did have economically disenfranchised people in the lower categories in terms of poverty level that didn't have the same opportunities that people had in my neighborhood. And that creates a level of frustration that then vented itself with whole communities turning on itself, and you saw all these buildings that were burned up. So that's the larger picture. And again, it just depends on where you lived in Detroit and what kind of neighborhood you lived in that determined the threat level and the level of security that you may or may not have felt before and after the riots. Now, when the riots ended, then again, this went on for from Sunday until Thursday. Many of the neighborhoods simply never really recovered to the level of robustness that they had had beforehand. Some of the neighborhoods did recover, but many of them didn't. And when you had whites who lived in certain neighborhoods, in some cases, and again, this had begun in the earlier part of the 1960s, you had neighborhoods that were changing, some of the neighborhoods that were largely Jewish. And then many of the Jewish families moved out to suburban areas. You had other ethnic groups, whites, who moved from Detroit to suburban areas, certainly when blacks started moving in their neighborhoods. So you had that kind of migration pattern taking place before the riots, but probably contributed to the riots. So in the late 1960s, the Detroit that I had grown up with was quite different because of the neighborhood patterns that I have described earlier, with the level of frustration because the recovery with the Detroit riots was not robust, and in some areas it didn't even exist at all. Some things were different. Certainly the city became a lot blacker, and the Afrocentric qualities of the city became very pronounced. You ultimately had, in that time, Jerome Cavanaugh was the mayor of Detroit. He was a pretty fair-minded Democratic mayor. And the governor was George Romney, who is the father of Mitt Romney. The governor, Mitt Romney, was the governor in Massachusetts and ran for president in 2012. And but his father was a very fair-minded, racially sensitive humanitarian who we had a great deal of respect for. So they did their very best to contain the riot, but the progress afterward was in many ways slow and sluggish. And other things took place. During that time, you had not only crime rates that rose, but also drug activities in cities like Detroit. Not just Detroit itself, but other cities became very pronounced. So by the 70s, and by that time I was off to college and been married, and I did not return to Detroit. Detroit was a city that was struggling quite a bit. The automobile industry was seesawing in terms of progress levels. Many of the jobs were beginning to be shipped overseas, and that was certainly impacted many of the workers in Detroit. And then you had plants that began to close because a lot of the jobs were exported overseas. And when you have these jobs to close, jobs to end, people getting laid off, and plants to close, you have epidemics and problems and areas of challenge, not just in Detroit, but in the surrounding areas. Flint, Michigan is one in particular where it was a very vibrant city, and it still is a very vibrant city, but it certainly had a lot of journeys because of plant closures that impacted their city. So you can't divorce this conversation from the automobile industry when you look at the 60s. You can't do that. You can't say that all the neighborhoods in Detroit were the same because they were not. And you have to look at the levels, the lifestyles, and the family units that were in place to get a better picture of what was taking place in Detroit, in addition to the Algiers Motel incident that took place during the riots. So all of those components were important. Now, I would also encourage you, if you want to learn more about this, to go again to my blog of August 10th. You can get it at my website. And that August 10th blog has a very intriguing interview by Judge Conrad Mallard. And you can just go and click through and listen to it. It's about 45 minutes long. He expands on what I've just talked about. Because he's from Detroit, he grew up in basically the same neighborhood that I grew up in, and we both graduated from the same high school, Cass Tech High School, in 1971. He went to California, came back to Detroit, was a lawyer and then a judge, and has remained very active. And I think he's now heading the medical center in Detroit. So I would encourage you to listen to his interview because it gives a lot more granular detail about all of the incidences that led up to the riots, the dynamics of the neighborhoods that took place, the threats of some of the neighborhoods, again, as I had explained earlier, and the aftermath of Detroit and the struggle that Detroit has had since the 60s. Detroit is very resilient. My brother and sister-in-law still live there. Speaking of this awful hurricane that's taking place, my niece, fortunately, is back in Detroit with her young baby and hoping that her husband gets there soon. She just flew up from Miami because of the hurricane situation. So the roots of Detroit are still very strong. And I also must say that if it were not for people like my brother and sister-in-law, their friends, and countless other people, my cousins and other relatives, who either went to school and went back to Detroit and stayed in the city and live within the city limits, it would even be tougher for the city to recover at this point. And I say that because the middle-class infrastructure of Detroit, it shrunk, but it did not evaporate. It's still very much in play. And many of the people who are the soldiers of the city, they get up in the morning, they go to work, they come home, they pay their taxes. Maybe some have retired or they're nearing retirement. That base of people represents the heart and soul of the city and the heart and soul that keeps the city moving forward. Yes, we have many people who are moving into the city or their businesses there, but I really think when you look at the long and short of it, you have to give credit to those who remained in Detroit, those who established their businesses in Detroit, like my brother, who is an attorney, those who pay taxes in Detroit, and in many cases, those whose children still are a part of the Detroit Public Schools or have graduated from the Detroit Public Schools, as I had. That's the baseline of Detroit. That's the heart and soul of Detroit. Those are the tireless individuals and families who have supported the city year in and year out and will be on board as the city continues to grow to greater greatness in the future. So that's really important to understand. So I hope that this will give you a sense of Detroit. I have many stories, and what I'm still going to be doing is convening a Zoom platform conversation with my friends, including Ken Reeves and Marilyn Anderson Chase and others who are here in the greater Boston area. Now, ironically, again, that movie Detroit was shot in and around Boston. That's just what's so ironic. But I want to put flesh to this, let you get a better sense of the people who have come from this great city where our values, our morals, our family units have deep roots in that city, whether we came from the South, as many black people came from the South, or whether they've been there even more so. It's a wonderful story and one that needs to be told. So I would encourage you to, again, go back if you haven't already and listen to the August 10th program, because I, again, set the stage for what happened with the riot, but also go and listen to Conrad Mallard's interview that's on the blog, and you can also get a backdrop of what happened with the Detroit riots. And hopefully this will give you a sense of, again, the people, the circumstances, the complexities. I haven't even really talked about the political landscape that took place, and this is all in the midst of the civil rights, when Dr. King came to our city in 1963 in June, before he went to the March on Washington, and all of the other components that make up the interesting set of circumstances that then led to a horrible situation that took place with the Algiers Motel and the movie that now has prompted me to talk about this all these years later. I thank you so much. We will look forward to more conversations about this. Also looking forward to the November 2nd Multicultural Conference that is right around the corner. I'm very excited. As our speakers get confirmed, I will be announcing all the speakers in the next few weeks. And if you are in this area, you can certainly fly up, as we've had people do before. Come on and get involved, and let's talk about diversity, multiculturalism, and all of the other aspects of discussions, both historically so and present tense. Thank you all so much. You can also visit me at mssconnect.com. That's mssconnect.com, and get all the information that you need about the Multicultural Symposium Series and the Multicultural Conference. And if you have your own stories about Detroit, please check me out on Facebook, or you can certainly leave a comment with the blog once you've had a chance to read it. You can go to Carol, C-A-R-O-L-E, at mssconnect.com and leave me a comment. I'm collecting them now because I've had friends and people who I know here in the greater Boston area, and I had no idea they had such deep roots in Detroit, whether they have friends they visited during that time period or at a later date they visited. So we will keep this kind of conversation going because it has everything to do with diversity, multiculturalism, and inclusion real time. Take care. Have a great week or weekend, and I'm praying for everybody in the path of Hurricane Irma that is barreling up the Caribbean and soon to be the Atlantic coastline. Kim, I will talk to you in the next program.